From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Friday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Our very own Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan, is in the house, ready to take your questions. Pick up the phone and give us a call. The number's 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985, and you can always send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams. Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Vanessa Sanchez handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every Friday, Colin Donovan, how are you?
Pretty good.
So first, at the top of the show, I need to issue an apology to producer extraordinaire Pedro Quiles and Dr. David Anders. I was supposed to, Tom Price is off today, and I was supposed to be in the studio with Dr. Anders last hour, and I totally forgot about it. So my apologies to both Pedro and Pedro's worried now that his Emmy has gone by the wayside because he didn't have the proper staffing in the studio to be able to make his YouTube magic, but hopefully we can make up for it this hour. Got an email here, Colin, from Renee, and she says, does the Catholic Church claim to have the correct and only authoritative Bible?
The Catholic Church makes no such claim in this sense that there is an original language to all of the books of the Bible. The original languages have not come down to us. So what the church does is it certifies that the text is consistent with the faith. So the church is always looking at, as scholars in other denominations do, and any other religions, Jewish scholars and so on, at the what's called the lower text, the actual, the Greek, the Hebrew, and Chaldean, occasionally others, that texts are found in. And from that, then the process of translation produces a text in the modern languages. So there are a number of ways in which errors can creep into a modern language text. One is through a deficient lower text, if you will, which the lower critics, as they're called, try to keep as pristine and consistent with what is likely the original as possible. And then also by the quality of the translation from those languages into the modern languages, sometimes which is good quality by the meanings of the particular language, and sometimes seems to have been a distortion to favor a particular theological position. What the church tries to do is keep our modern scriptures in whatever language as close to the original as we understand it. We think we have a good basis in the fact that St. Jerome, around the year 400, translated the scriptures into Latin. He did it by a great effort. He went to the Holy Land. He lived there for years. He consulted rabbis. He gathered not only linguistic hints of what, say, the Old Testament scripts meant. Obviously, in those days, he would have been competent in Greek and Latin. And so he produced what has been called the Latin Vulgate. And this remains the reference translation, if you will, and to that extent, the reference text of the language translations of into other languages. So the church has currently what's called a neo-Vulgate, since the Vulgate itself has gone through corrections over many times over the centuries, in part because, surprisingly, after all these years, we keep finding ancient texts from the 3rd and 4th century in libraries and in other places. And so we have more and more texts to verify what the lower text would be, what the actual text was, and corrections to then get made, and those may lead to variations in the translation. There are cases in the scripture where the uncertainty of passages, whether something that is in the modern text was actually in the original, and that can be corrected by the discovery of ancient texts. So it's an ongoing process. For the Catholic, it's not troubling, because we have passed down the apostolic teaching in the church. The church possesses it, and it possesses the charism of interpreting that teaching. And so the scripture is important and necessary for preserving the record in writing of the revelation of the Old Covenant and of Christ and the apostles. But ultimately, the church then relies upon its understanding of the faith as to what it teaches, referencing those scriptures, referencing the tradition of teaching that's passed down in the church that corresponds to those original scriptures. On the other hand, if your reliance is on the accuracy of the text, a common argument I've heard from non-Catholics is that, well, you know, between the Dead Sea Scrolls and modern discoveries, we know that the likelihood that the modern text corresponds more or less exactly with the original writings is high. And I think that's a fairly true statement. But then you're always dependent upon the interpretive ability of the person who is interpreting it and saying what it means. And without the apostolic tradition, it is private interpretation. The tradition is a public interpretation handed down over 20 centuries. But if for an individual to pick up a Bible concluding that the text is faithful to the original, and it's likely highly close to that, 99%+, and then saying, now this enables me to interpret its meaning, that is simply a logical fallacy. So the church doesn't rely on the pristineness of that text, although I think we scholars generally agree that what we have today is probably as close to the original as has been available in human history. And that is a great blessing, to have such a high quality text available to be translated into our modern languages.
What do you think is a more impressive term, 20 centuries or 2 millennia? I hadn't really thought about it until I just heard you say 20 centuries, and then I thought, they both sound pretty impressive.
They are pretty, well, you know, 20 centuries, we need to start thinking about this, because although we don't know the exact date of the crucifixion, some scholars have said about 30 AD, 30 or 31, but like the Nativity, where we celebrated the 2,000 years of Christ's birth in 2000, when he may have been born before that, we will celebrate in 2030 the 2,000th years of the redemption, 2033,
thank you, yeah,
the 2,000 years of the redemption. So 20 centuries may be, in this context, more impressive than simply 2,000 years, although that's impressive enough.
Just getting started on a Friday edition of EWTN's Open Line Friday. Unfettered access to a professional theologian, our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan. If you'd like to ask Colin a question, pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2 1-800-259-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. That's openline, all one word, at ewtn.com. And you may want to put Colin or Friday in the subject line with your question. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Got a great item at EWTN's religious catalog. In the Manger, it's a jigsaw puzzle and Advent calendar all rolled into one. It's a traditional 24-day countdown to Christmas. You can do that with this truly unique jigsaw puzzle and Advent calendar. It includes 24 numbered boxes, each containing one section of the puzzle. That's for if you don't want your children having chocolate, this is a great gift. Beginning December 1st, you can assemble the pieces in the box numbered 1. Assemble the pieces in the next numbered box each day through December 24th when the puzzle will be completed for Christmas. Each piece has its box number on the back so that when the season ends, you can put it back together and have it ready for next year. When complete, the puzzle will measure just under 27 inches by 19 inches. It's a beautiful bonus poster that comes with it of the manger scene to assist in assembly. It's 1,000 pieces in 24 numbered cardboard boxes and are fully interlocking and produce a thick premium quality puzzle board. And it's available now at EWTN's religious catalog. That's EWTNRC.com. They're offering free standard shipping on online orders of $75 or more. That is standard shipping in the continental U.S. only. Use the code FREE at checkout. We're going to talk to Christina in just a moment. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We've got a birthday in the friary today. Father Leonard Mary Revilla, Father Leonard, who many of you will know from watching the Daily Mass, and many of you will know from YouTube with his various food reviews. I'm particularly fond of his annual review of fish sandwiches on the first Friday of Lent. Those are always abundantly entertaining. But you know, is he still the community servant?
He is. He was reelected for another term.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. It's like three in a row, right?
No, I don't believe.
Is it only
two?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I think they're term limited. I'm not
so he
positive.
Is the community servant, kind of heading up the friary over there right now. And you know, Colin, I know that this is something that you'll be aware of, but we were on a roll there for a while where we had three different pairs of friars that were going through formation together. Mm-hmm. And we really get a blessing here at EWTN and all of our viewers and members of the EWTN family because they get an opportunity to, especially during their transitional diaconate year, mm-hmm. watch these friars as they go through formation before they're actually ordained priests. And it's a great blessing, I think.
It is, and I think our audience is familiar with the various stages as well because they see, for example, usually the mass in which the vows are made mm-hmm. and the bishop comes to receive the vows and so on. So it's a little touch and experience of religious life and priestly life that hopefully inspires some that this is the life the Lord is calling them to, whether it's in this community or other communities.
You know, it's Father Leonard is an interesting guy. He's a big dude, but he's got such a gentle spirit, and he and I want to make sure I word this correctly, but He has a very...
I'm taking notes.
Well, he just has a very... he has a very simple speech style.
Yeah, he does.
And he speaks in a very simple sort of a way. And you find yourself... I do, anyway. I find myself, when he celebrates the Mass, I find myself in the middle of the homily going, well, that was brilliant. Yeah. And you just... It sometimes sneaks up on you because... He has such an accessible way about him.
Right. And I think sometimes people are looking for erudition, meaning that they're looking for a great intellectual exposition in a homily. But some of the best homilies are those that are simple, from the heart, and reach directly to the hearts of other people, because they actually move us down the path of holiness. And I think we have all categories of homilies here at the network, but I think for the heartfelt and homilies that reach the heart, his are very, very good.
So say a prayer today for Father Leonard on his birthday, and also recently elected to a second term as the community servant for the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. So please keep Father Leonard in your prayers. Christina is up first today. She is a first-time caller in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Christina, thank you so much for holding. You are on with Colin Donovan.
Yes, hello. Thank you. In the Dallas newspaper here on Fridays, I always list like a lot of events throughout the Metroplex that are happening.
Sure.
Probably at least 50, car shows and film festivals and so on, pumpkin patches, haunted houses. One of the things they've been listing is these celebrations, I think they're Hindu, for Diwali, D-I-W-A-L-I, and it sounded like a very colorful, maybe fun event. And then it occurred to me, I don't know if there's a problem to go to these, because I'm sure they started out as maybe worshiping or thinking of pagan gods. Of course, that's not listed in the paper, but... I'm just wondering about the appropriateness as a Catholic to go to something like this.
Yeah, it's a Hindu festival, and it certainly has religious roots. I don't believe it's necessarily about a god. I think it's an individual returning, and the lights represent their returning, adopted by other religions in that part of the world, and so a celebration, probably generic in some respects. So obviously for a Catholic, you can't buy into the religious dimension. But so, for example, here in Birmingham, we have a number of cultural festivals with religious roots that go on every year, both the Orthodox and the Melkites and the Maronites. They put on their festivals.
Most of them revolve around food.
That's very good food, I might add. I don't think many non-Catholics go to these, and probably those who otherwise would turn their nose up at anything that smacks of the liturgical sacramental religion, such as Orthodoxy and Catholicism does. So I think
grape leaves are a proof that St. Thomas could have used for the existence of God.
Why is that?
Because they're delicious.
Okay. But in any case, I think as the cultural element of it, if you wish to go with no intention of rejoicing in the spiritual side of that, to taste the food and see the celebrations, the probably lights and I don't know what they do. That part of it is fine, but no, obviously the religious element is nothing that a Christian should be embracing. But it sounds like, and I suspect that it's a very, that it's as much a cultural celebration as it is a religious celebration.
How's that, Christina?
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate getting your opinion. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for the phone call.
And I bet Christians who are civil authorities, whether Catholic or Protestant, by necessity and their obligations, they wish to be welcoming and helpful to a variety of religions. And so in the course of their duties, they go to these things and so on. So it's in this particular case, it has a lot to do with the motive. And I think, for... experiencing the culture is a legitimate motive in such a case, especially in our society when we're forced to live and rub elbows with people of a great variety of religions and ideologies.
Wide open phone lines for you, 833-288-EWTN with your questions for our Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan, 833-288-3986. Lizbeth would like to know, what is the difference between the Eastern Rites and Western Rites regarding the sacrament of confirmation?
I can't tell you liturgically what is the difference, but obviously it's the, in both cases, it's calling for an increase of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. Procedurally, I'm sure there are differences. One difference is likely, in both religions, you could have infants born into the religion and you could have adults converting to it. For the Orthodox, the three sacraments of initiation, baptism, confirmation, and Holy Communion are given at the same time, regardless of the age of the person. So an infant is given all three sacraments initially. And so, as an adult convert would be. And in the Western Rites, in the Roman Rite, for example, we baptize infants and then we confirm them and give them a first Holy Communion later on, in many cases at the age of 7, and sometimes in a staggered pattern here in the United States, you'll see confirmations as late as high school. So that's a different approach of the timing of it. The Orthodox Church conforms, and the Eastern Catholic Churches conform more to the original practice because the bishop was more involved. And you can imagine having to get a bishop involved in the entirety of your sacraments in this way. So the baptism, confirmation, and in Holy Eucharist, the confirmation would have been the bishop being present, but obviously assisted by the priest and so on. And that's more or less preserved in the East, Eastern churches, Catholic and Orthodox, differently in the West. And I think it probably has a lot to do with most of the Eastern churches, Catholic and Orthodox, have a certain regional centrality to them. So they're a regional base. They're a cultural and ethnic base. You know, the evangelized Rus, who became the Russian Orthodox, then the various Catholic Eastern churches eventually. So you get a linguistic, you get the Greek, you get the different what country I'm trying to think of here for a sec. But anyway, you get the different national and ethnic churches that way. In the West, there has been much more missionary activity in the sense that it was largely the Western churches, the Roman Church, that brought the faith to the Americas, for example, or to Oceania, although there's some Eastern cases could be cited there as well. And so if a priest is doing that, he couldn't confirm. So baptism, Eucharist, the other sacraments would be fine, but then you would need a bishop to do the confirmation. So certain practices developed, I think, for more practical reasons than theological, and we still continue to follow those to this day. And that is the different, the separation of these three sacraments, whereas in the East they generally are not separated.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Susan in Boise, Idaho, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
One of our great EWTN radio partners needs to hear from you next week, Catholic Spirit Radio, with 12 stations now serving central and northern Illinois, plus Whitewater, Wisconsin, kicks off their fall fund appeal on Wednesday. So make sure you take care of Catholic Spirit Radio and any of the miracles that are the Catholic radio stations that may be present in your local area. They are worthy of your support. Still an open line at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. As advertised, we go to Susan in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Susan, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hello there.
Hello, Susan.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Well, not all that quick, but I have become more and more interested in the Catholic faith over the years. I'm 74 years old. I think a variety of things have kind of pulled me that direction here more the last few years, to the point that I went to our local, the church that's closest to my house, a couple of months ago, and sat down with the woman that is in charge of the various classes, because I would need to go through the inquiry classes and then another set of classes and so on. And so all of that I'm very interested in. There was a questionnaire that I filled out. Had I been baptized? Yes. Did I have documentation of that? Yes. Baptized Episcopalian when I was very young. And then we got down to whatever question it was, and it was, have you ever been married? And it stopped me dead in my tracks. I've been married to the same fantastic man for 47, 48 years almost.
Mm-hmm.
When I was very young, I made a very foolish decision that 2.5 months later, I corrected. I did go through, I don't have any documentation of it anymore. I've burned all that stuff a long time ago, for 2.5 months. And so she said, that is a bit of a problem, that I would have to, find the original or get a copy. This was clear across the country in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I was 21 years old. Find the documentation and all of that and present all of that. And then I kind of froze at that point and quit listening. And I don't know where she was going to go with that. If I went through all of the classes and did decide to join, how is that a problem, and how do I rectify that problem?
Well, the problem is the church teaches that marriage is indissoluble. There can be exceptions to that. For example, if he were not a baptized person, or you were not a baptized person and you were becoming baptized, which is not the case, then there are other kinds of solutions to it. But when the case of the baptized person, as fraught, despite the shortness of that marriage, which frankly is a very good sign in your favor, a very good data point, if you will, in your favor, the church would consider that a valid marriage until demonstrated otherwise. So the purpose of the nullity process, annulment is a short way of saying all of this, the purpose of the process is to determine the validity of that marriage insofar as you can, and there is, insofar as the church can. And on the basis of that, the conclusion can be made that it was invalid. I think the brevity of it, as I said, argues very much in your favor. Unfortunately, I think it will require you to do some documentation insofar as you're able to. Now, Pope Francis put in some processes for cases where some of these things are not possible. There was already a good deal of that in the church law before that, but he added some more in his motu proprio on this. And so I think you should begin the catechesis, and you should begin to look into that to gather what information you can. If you have any contact with people in the region, for example, or people you both knew at that time, your supposition that he might very well be dead is correct. He might very well be dead, and that would simplify things for you. Then you would only need to do what's called a convalidation of this 47-plus year marriage that you've been living. But from the church's point of view, civilly or not sacramentally. And so I would encourage going through both, and along the way, I think you will probably learn that it might be simpler than you imagine, but I think trust to God, trust to your own, his desire he's planted in your heart, and see what the results are before you decide this isn't for me.
And I'm sure that the parish has something in place for someone to walk alongside her to get this process underway.
Yeah, and in the end, it won't be an employee of the diocese. It'll be the tribunal that makes these decisions according to the law of the church, which provides for circumstances where information is lacking and unavailable and inaccessible, and you can't, this might be such a case. So I think you trust to the church's goodwill and your own goodwill and start the march.
God bless you, Susan. We'll keep you in our prayers. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Mel is up next in West Palm Beach, Florida, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Mel, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for all you do. Just a simple question. Regarding the second commandment, using God's name in vain, I was by myself and I was trying to get into a door and I used it, kind of came out by itself out of frustration in a adjective towards a certain door. Is that a mortal sin if it slips?
Okay.
Oh, I can't believe you did that, Mel.
Yeah, no, you're banned from the church, Mel. No, let's start with what the commandment means. The commandment means that you may not call God to witness to your lie or sin or whatever. So imagine going into court and you say, "So help me God," in a serious matter, you lie. That would be a mortal sin. Now let's say that you the disrespect that is given to the divine name and the name of Jesus and the Blessed Mother, for that matter, those things which are holy because of their connection to God or because it is God you're talking about, we should not casually do that. But the casual usage, such as you describe, is very seldom mortal sin. Unless you just don't give a bleep. So I think the fact you're asking the question says that you do give one, and therefore you try to restrain this habit, like all involuntary habits and that are weaknesses of tongue or other parts of our flesh. We have to try to corral them and bring them under the tutelage of our mind. And so that's a work in progress, and God knows that. So, no, I don't think you likely committed a mortal sin, but I think that's the way to look at it going forward.
Does that give you some comfort, Mel?
It certainly does. I was going to go for the 5:30 p.m. Mass.
Well, now how long has it been? Maybe a good confession is needed for other reasons too. But I don't think if that's your only fault in recent days since your last confession, you're good to go probably.
God bless you, Mel. Thanks so much for the call today. 833-288. EWTN is our toll-free number.
He's never been in the service, apparently. No one could go to communion.
Julia is in Washington listening today on the EWTN app. Julia, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, Colin. Thank you so much for everything you guys do there. We appreciate all of you. You help us so much. I'll start with my question. My question is, and then I'll frame it for you. We do Bible study every night after our family prayer time. I have a senior in high school, and then my two boys are training in MMA. They're 21 and 23, and it's a full-time job. My question is for a reference.
Consider me ignorant. What is MMA?
Mixed martial arts.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Very Cage good. Fighting.
So, yes.
Yeah, gotcha. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. If it was my choice, they'd be priests. But, you know, it's not my choice. Anyway,
the game's not over yet.
No. Yeah.
I know. I keep praying.
It's self-defense, so maybe.
So they're up there 6 days a week training. They're gone, you know, 9-10 hours a day. They consider, you know, who they train with as a second family. So one of the people that they train with, I'm so sorry, my timer's going off. Let me turn that off. One of the people that they trained with was living with his girlfriend under his father's roof. Mm-hmm. Or their coach said, you know, move closer to the gym, and the girlfriend is now going to support him so he can go professional. And my boys, so they're moving in together. They were already living together, and now they're moving into their own home together. My boys came home and said, hey, Mom, can we use the truck? You know, so-and-so's moving in. And I was like, oh, sure, you know, and then I thought about it. I'm like, oh, my goodness, the Holy Spirit convicted my heart. I'm like, I cannot do this. I cannot help them move in together in mortal sin. Well, they're not Christian. They're not, you know, they don't believe in anything. And my son said, well, Mom, they don't even know. I said, yeah, but we do, and we have to answer to God, you know. And this is mortal sin, and, you know, and I tried to explain to him, like, you know, you wouldn't let them use your car to go to an abortion, you know, I said, they're both mortal sins, you know, they both kill the life of grace of God in your soul. I said, so I cannot in good conscience do that. And he said, well, Mom, we're supposed to be good Christian examples. How do we do that? Because, you know, we help each other with everything, and I tried to explain to him, you're choosing the lesser good, the temporal good over the eternal. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking for resources. How, you know, of course he saw my point and obeyed, of course, but how, he said, why don't we do this for a Bible study, you know, after our prayer time and try to get, you know, in there, because like the word abortion is not in the Bible. So I pointed to, you know, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, but it really made my heart so sad because sin is so prevalent in the world that my boys, who I Catholic homeschooled, took to daily mass, they don't even see, they didn't even see that it was a mortal mm-hmm. sin because sin is so normal. So, Tom, mm-hmm. what do you got? What do you think I could do to help them, you know, embrace that?
Well, I think it's education on and prayer. I mean, those are the solutions. I wouldn't make too much of what for them seemed to be the natural desire to help, for starters. I would recognize that's a good Christian instinct in them. I understand the unwillingness to want to seem to be contributing to the to their situation. On the other hand, a counter argument would be that you're not engaging in their lifestyle, but you're helping them move, and it's maybe the occasion to simply, rather than a lecture, to simply have them. I mean, of the teachers of the martial arts, rather simply to make the excuse that no, we're not available and able to do that. When you need us, you'll have to find some other way. Because in the end, when you give fraternal correction to people, you want to know them, and you want to know have the opportunity and the hope of success. I don't think this is the situation. Now, with your own boys, obviously, you are free to instruct them in the truth, and you should, and to give them the reason and logic why you know, it's better not to do it. I don't think it's a question of sin. It's what's called material cooperation. You're not cooperating in the taking of a human life, which is gravely evil. And as I said, you're not giving you're moving their furniture is really what you're doing. But it's still, at the same time, I think it's like going to such a wedding, or unlike going to such a wedding, because that would be a statement of validation for that. So I would discourage them from doing the task, and I would explain to them why, and it may be some opportunity in their when they can explain to this fellow and his girlfriend why we put such a high value on marriage. That might be a positive starting point rather than starting with a rebuke.
Does that help, Julia?
Yeah. We didn't say anything to their friend or the girlfriend. Their coach is trying to help them, you know, get married. So he's very Christian. Mm-hmm. So I'm good there. And my son ended up saying, you know, oh, sorry, my mom needs the truck. And I said, well, you don't want to lie, you know, because he already said he would. So that was not good.
Well, water over the dam now, as they say. So I think be grateful for the semi-positive result of all of this. And if in friendships something can be said to them at some point, then there really has to be an opportunity which is prepared by grace, because obviously they have to be able to receive it and act on it with goodwill. So I think that's the, you know, it's an unsatisfactory conclusion, no doubt, but I think that's the one that comes in this circumstance.
Yeah, God bless you, Julian. Thank you for caring. Another great podcast at EWTN's Podcast Central is The Messy Family Project. Mike and Alicia Hernan believe that being a good parent starts with being a great spouse, but it's hard, messy work, and we're not meant to do it alone, so join them on this journey. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN's Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/podcasts today. David's up next in the great state of Arizona, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. David, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yeah, I have a question in regards to the human body. Mm-hmm. You know, the church is very clear about the dignity of how you treat human beings and the body, especially when it comes to burial. Mm-hmm. And that we prefer a body burial versus cremation. But I'm confused as to what the church teaches, how the church gets away with sending body parts to saints. You know, like tongue goes here, and then parts of the heart go over there, and then this guy's leg. You know what I mean? It seems like we chop up these people that are saints, but we tell other people that that's not the correct way to go.
Well, that maybe a little bit erroneous description of what's taking place in the distribution of relics. But no, the basic question is quite legitimate. So the difference is that the saint is somebody who, having lived a profoundly Christian life, received our Lord in the Holy Eucharist many times, and died in the state of perfect grace according to that degree in which they were in. In other words, without any dross of sin on their soul, the church concludes that they are in heaven. Their body is judged as having been sanctified by grace and by the Eucharist, the reception of the Eucharist and the sacraments over the years. And the church found very early on that the relics of the saints produced miracles. And so we have this to a certain extent in Scripture, because the healing's brought about by the handkerchief of St. Paul. That's essentially what a relic is, something that was a holy person or was used by a holy person. And on that basis, the appeal to that person by virtue of contact with the relic, possession of the relic, as an incitement to pray and to seek their intercession with God, is considered a holy thing. And by the very same underlying logic, the respect that is owed to the body of our deceased, who may not have been saints, is to preserve them whole and entire and to bury them as they died in the ground. And as you noted, with some permissions being possible for cremation. So it's ultimately the same logic, but the distinction is the person who dies in grace, and which is not to say, you know, mom and dad and granny and grandpa didn't die in the state of grace, but who died as saints. And so the church very early on preserved the relics of holy men and women from the apostles. I think the relics, there is some place that claims the relics of all the apostles and many other saints down through history. And there's usually miracles connected with those places to sort of demonstrate the truth of that being the case. And so the church gives great honor to the saints. And yes, I suppose it seems a little bit odd, the soft tissues, unless there's a... I would say this, if the person doesn't fully corrupt, and we have quite a few incorrupt saints who were not embalmed and who nonetheless, decades or even centuries after their death, their flesh is still incorrupt. Obviously, those saints are not being carved up. God is trying to witness to the truth, perhaps, of the resurrection or something in that through that. But that's not true of most saints. They go through the normal process of corruption that, Adam and Eve brought upon us when they sinned. And so their remains typically are their bones. And it's usually either a complete bone or the whole, or even a skeleton in many cases, or some part of the bone that is given. Sometimes it's the flesh. I've seen the relics of the flesh. Sometimes it's whole body parts. Saint Anthony of Lisbon, who is better known as Saint Anthony of Padua, was in a Augustinian monastery in Coimbra, Portugal, when the first martyrs of the Franciscans arrived. And those relics that were brought to Coimbra in the, what is that, the 1200s, late middle 1200s or so, or those relics are still there in Coimbra, those leg bones and so on of those first Franciscan martyrs of Morocco. And they're honored with great respect because they represented the effort of the church to evangelize the Islamic peoples of North Africa and the difficulties certainly that were presented by doing that. So it's the value of the example of the saints and the reputation of the saints and the fact that miracles have occurred through relics is why the church gives them such great respect. And would do so even if no miracles have been attributed to particular cases.
We head next to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Maria is listening on JMJ Radio today. Maria, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, Colin. The name a little Audrey Santo came to my mind today because of a medical crisis in my family.
Mm-hmm.
Little Audrey drowned when she was 3 years old, and she wasn't able to communicate until she never was ever able to communicate. Mm-hmm. She died at age 23. Now, there was many miracles that occurred in her room, and I was at one of her masses many, many years ago. There was many priests there. I don't remember if there was a bishop there. But I'm just going on her website now because of the crisis that's in my family. And I see that she's not even made a servant of God. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
No, I remember when we did have some programming on EWTN, it was quite a remarkable case, such as you described it. The process is quite lengthy. Obviously, we get asked many times, you know, about Mother Angelica's. The manner in which the church requires that things be established before a cause is begun, the processes both locally for that to take place, which require the bishop and ultimately Rome, those are lengthy and complicated, both technically with regard to the things which the church requires, and just in terms of the paperwork and the documentation that's needed for that. So I don't know in her specific case, but it's very often the case that people who have died recently are not, you know, they may be in some stage of that, of information gathering by interested parties or even by the diocese in which she died. And so the explanation of her not being a servant of God is really quite easy. Sufficient time has not passed, or procedures and practices have not been yet fulfilled, if that is, you know, underway. And I have no idea whether it's actually underway at this time.
On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Vanessa Sanchez, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks for another great week of EWTN's Open Line. Back at it Monday with Father Trujillo. Until then, God bless.